welcome to Turn the Page, the official podcast of the Syosset Public Library.
This is Jessica with Syosset Library's Turn the Page podcast, and my librarian co-host is...
Sharon. Hello, good morning.
And we are welcoming back one of our favorite guests.
Hi, I'm Sarah Marshall. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for coming back and agreeing to be re-traumatized with us. The reason I say this is, so we interviewed Sarah back in, I think it was like the summer, about You're Wrong About, which is one of your podcasts. Mm-hmm. You have another podcast, which is Why Our Dads. After we talked about You're Wrong About, we kind of stayed on a little bit longer talking about just how traumatizing children's movies were in the 70s, 80s, and early 90s. And I was like, do you ever want to come back and talk to us about that?
And I was like, yeah. And also again, yes, we talked about Bluth.
Oh, Bluth. Yes.
Bluth animation.
Yeah.
Last time, and now we're going to the live action realm, but I feel like just as tear jerkily.
We can't talk about traumatic childhood media without discussing The Neverending Story.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
And there's a few reasons why, again, you know, we're very excited to have you back, but I also thought about this one because of Why Our Dads, because there is a dad in this movie. Bastion's dad is just, oh my God, that he's in it for a short amount of time in the movie. And that scene is heart-wrenching.
Yeah. It is Gerald McRaney of Major Dad really playing to type.
And oh, totally.
Yeah, it's funny because this is the first time I've watched this movie since I was probably 11. And I was just wildly in love with the book. And I remember just not really having a hard time seeing the movie for what it was, because the book was so fresh in my mind. And, you know, the movie, because it is a 90-minute movie, can only fit in like an eighth of the material, probably. So if you feel loyal to the concept of everything that you know being represented, it's never going to live up to that. But I remember at that time, like the way the dad was depicted really making an impression on me, because that was one where I think, even like with my allegiance to the book, I felt like the way the movie showed him to us was stronger and made just, you know, just kind of conveyed the whole situation in about 45 seconds.
So that's actually interesting you say that. So yeah, Gerald McRaney, and I knew Major Dad was a show and I wouldn't watch it because I looked at him and I just saw him pouring egg yolks into orange juice or whatever that was that he was drinking.
That was trauma.
It's the like, ignore my grieving son health shake.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, because like his whole thing is like, he's like, we got to get past this. And it's like, get past your child's mother dying? It's as if he just lost a soccer game.
So one of the things that's interesting when you talk about the book, because I saw this movie before the book, I was probably 6 or 7. My parents came to the Syosset Public Library and checked the VHS out and put me upstairs in their room where the only VHS player was and just left me to my own devices to be traumatized. And like, they had no idea. They're like, oh, it's a fantasy movie. You know,
that's
like
what parents always say. They're like, it's a fantasy movie. Aren't about people and sadness and weird sex parts.
Oh, no, none of that. Absolutely not. So the thing about the book was, this book is rooted in trauma. The movie is rooted in trauma. You absolutely cannot get away from the connection to World War II that is both in the movie and the book. The passage regarding Bastion's dad in the book really shows that there's a distance because he's in despair. And the passage is, Bastion couldn't talk to his father anymore. There was an invisible wall around his father. No one could get through to him. He never found faults and never praised. Even when Bastion was put back in school, his father hadn't said anything. He had only looked at him in his sad, absent way, and Bastian felt that as far as his father was concerned, he wasn't there at all. That is how his father usually made him feel.
It feels more like a bad European dad than a bad American dad, actually. I feel like the movie gives us classic bad American dad.
Totally, because yes. His father is, buck up, son. You know, oh, you were late to school. And Bastian's like, I wasn't late to school last time. You know, you have to keep your feet on the ground. What are you drawing in your book? Unicorns? It's like toxic masculinity.
Or 80s masculinity.
It's like 80s masculinity. And this poor kid is grieving his mother. There's a very different feel there. Mm-hmm. Just some notes. So Michael Ende, which his name actually translates to end, which I always found fascinating.
Yeah.
Is that ironic or is that like Alanis ironic?
I think it's cool. Yeah.
It's cool. Yeah.
It's also kind of like, you know, one of those dentists named Dr. Toth. You wonder if they were like subtly guided toward it by their name.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, so Michael Ende, he was born in 1929 and some crazy stuff happened in his youth. You know, he was in Europe.
When he was a boy.
His family moved to Munich when he was six. And when he was 12, which is the age that Bastian is, he experienced his first bombing, the bombing of Munich, and described his street to literally have been on fire. And when he was visiting an uncle, he experienced the bombing of Hamburg. And he has all of these quotes about it. They're absolutely horrific.
Yeah.
His father was a painter who was labeled, his artwork was considered degenerate by the Nazis. And he was given his papers, I think, at 15 to basically join the German army and fight against the Allies. And he tore it up and said, no effing way. Because I'm not doing this. He joined the resistance. Three of his classmates who did join the army died their very first day on assignment. And he saw people who deserted strung up by their neck on trees. So it's like Jojo Rabbit, but without Taika Waititi's whimsical imaginary Hitler friend. It's just very sad. And he was very opposed to considering The Neverending Story just a children's story.
Well, I mean, that is what has always really struck me about it, that like, and actually it reminds, like, of all the books I read at that age in that general genre, what it reminds me of the most is So You Want to Be a Wizard by Diane Duane, which is also like involves a concept of nothingness. They're fighting against entropy at least part of the time, and also like that one, I remember just involving like what I remember being very adult concepts, like not adult, like sexual, but adult, like, no, like we're going to talk about physics and we're going to talk about math and the universe and science and astronomy and just sort of how everything works and like create a system of magic that makes sense to some degree scientifically. And I feel like The Neverending Story had that kind of sophistication, but about sort of maybe ideas of like semiotics and meaning and what it is to create reality through text, I guess, among other things. And also what happens when, you know, when despair takes over geopolitically.
Yes. Yeah, I think when I was researching this, there was a video I was watching and the commentator, and I suppose if you've only seen the movie and you don't know too much about the background, was like, oh, the nothing represents children turning their backs on books. And I'm like, it's kind of about Nazis and fascism and turning your back on just fantasy in general.
Like, it never seemed like a metaphor for, and this idea of like, this, I need to reread the book because I just want to return to like what I experienced as a child and see how much I was missing the whole time, because like, I guess it never occurred to me that it was any kind of metaphor at that age. I just was able to take it very literally. And it was very scary as a literal thing.
Full disclosure, I have not read the book, but I have seen the movie many, many times. Mm-hmm. And so I'm coming from sort of a different place where I'm just learning things about the differences between the book and the movie, which hopefully some of our listeners will also, you know, be able to relate to and maybe make them want to pick up the book as this does. So like the concept of the nothing in the book seems to, and I'm asking because it's sort of a question, like seems to be more terrifying and more, you know, obviously there's more of a description of it in the book. And, you know, the character, the one who is the rock chewer. Mm-hmm. And does he have I know he does have a German name, which I'm not going to be able to pronounce because it's Warren Krasnar.
Is he the rock biter?
The rock biter. Sorry, I said rock chewer.
I mean,
I don't think he minds.
different species. Let's not get confused. So he was talking about like the nothing and the quote that I found when I was researching it about like, you know, it would be a physical, like chunks would go missing. If you sort of put your arm or foot or hand, whatever you put in, it would be gone. It wouldn't hurt. It was just a part of whoever would just be missing. And then he said some would even fall in on purpose if they got too close to the nothing because it had an irresistible attraction. And that to me was like, whoa, because it really, in the movie, it's something to run away from and to be afraid of. And I don't feel like they really covered that aspect of it, which to me is this whole other, you want to talk about fascism, you want to talk about leaning into something horrible. So yeah, just that to me made me really curious about what else in the book.
And there is a quote from Enda himself where he describes being in the middle of his street being on fire as almost having this feeling of euphoria, like a moth to a flame, like he almost wanted to run into it. So this movie is considered at the root of a lot of millennial zennial trauma. Interesting fact also, the book was translated by Ralph Manheim, who also translated Mein Kampf.
Wow.
Yeah. And he also translated the transcripts of the war crimes trial of Adolf Eichmann.
Oh, wow. God, yeah, so do you think the Neverending Story was like a fun job or was that just equally serious?
Well, you know, I think that the connection is important because of just the root of the whole thing. I think it was probably certainly more fun, but I think it was also probably very personal to him as well, because he knew the weight of what had to be said when he was translating this for an American audience. Now, the director of The Neverending Story is Wolfgang Petersen, who directed Das Boot, which is another World War II story.
Which my dad also showed to me when I was 11 for some reason.
Oh boy, I'm so sorry.
Yeah, wow. I don't know why, but.
Yeah, so he decided after Das Boot, he was going to do something fun and different. And The Neverending Story was a phenomenon in Germany. It was almost like their Harry Potter, I suppose. You know, people would pass it to each other, you know, like at sleepovers, and it was a real big deal. And it was the most expensive non-American and Russian film made at that time.
Really?
Yeah.
It is a beautiful movie. Like I really, anything with large puppets and practical effects really makes me happy.
If you visit Germany, there is a museum where you can ride Falkor, by the way.
I saw that. Yeah.
Have you been?
No, but I'm dying to go. And once the pandemic is over, we should all go.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I had a plan. I developed a plan a year ago, early pandemic, because for a while I was fixated on finding the perfect large Totoro plush, which I never found one online that I was satisfied with. So I still don't have one. But in the process, I learned that there is like a giant Totoro inside a ticket-taking booth at the Studio Ghibli Museum, or is it the Miyazaki Museum? But anyway, some kind of an animation museum. And yeah, so I love the idea of like going to Germany and Japan and the legacy of like the quote axis of evil being like these cute, lovable cartoon characters who like boomers' children grew up with, and that's our association with those countries.
I agree, and I'm dying to ride Falcor. I have a friend who did it.
I want to ride Totoro. They don't let you, but I'll try it.
That's too bad. You can get a giant Totoro bean.
They really need a rideable Totoro.
Yeah, they do. Yeah. So when it came to translating this to the American audience, obviously Peterson, who had won Academy Awards for Das Boot, was like, I'm going to go to Steven Spielberg. Because who else other than Steven Spielberg would be able to understand what American audiences want from fantasy? So the theory behind Fantasia or Fantastica in the book is this Jungian theory of like the collective unconscious that all of these human fantasies live together in one area. We haven't even gotten into the plot of the movie. So, okay, dialing it back. For those of you who have never experienced the NeverEnding Story, I don't know why you're listening to this, but welcome. It is the story of a young boy named Bastian Box, who, as we explained, lost his mother, and he is very depressed. He's 12 years old, and
he's being bullied.
He's being bullied.
And in the book, he's fat, which is a tragic omission from the film.
Yes, yes. In the he's awkward, which he is in the film, played by Baron Oliver, by the way, who is a very interesting person now. Yeah, well, we can talk about that later. He's fat. He's awkward. He is not confident. So basically, like, he's all of those things, except they decided to cast Baron Oliver, who was not overweight.
But he's a classic fantasy reader. Like, I feel like as a kid seeing, like, because one of the problems to me as a kid, like when I would read these books about other kids, they would be off having adventure. And I was like, that's great, but I'm struggling to identify with you because I am clearly sitting here in my room reading about you. So like the idea of having a character who is sitting in a room reading and you are sitting in a room reading about him sitting in a room reading is brilliant. You know, I think it's like Umberto Eco for children.
Absolutely.
It's like Italo Calvino for children. It's both.
yeah, for sure. And he steals this book from Coriander's bookshop, and I, which to me is like the third floor of the Strand in New York City.
Powell's used to be like that, and it's very user friendly now, but it used to be known for its jerks.
Man, yeah, Coriander was kind of a jerk to Bastian. And
was he the trickster character, though? Was like, that was, you know?
That's a good point. Mm-hmm. He really tricked. He, you know, it was almost like
I wouldn't want to read that book, little boy.
Yeah.
Yes, like pre-Lemony Snicket. Like, don't open this book. Horrible things happen in this book. This book isn't safe. So he tells Bastian, like, Bastian's hiding from bullies. He says, oh, you know, you don't want to read this book. This book isn't safe. You can't escape from this book like you would when you read other books. So he steals the book, which Coriander smirks as he's watching him run away. Mm-hmm. He skips school, steals the key to his school attic, which is full of, I don't even know why half those things are in the attic.
There's, I think, like, in Germany, they just have taxidermy in schools, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Skeleton.
Well, you said theater props. That, you know, that's why there was like a wolf's head on a pike or whatever.
Or when they do the wolf head play.
I mean, of course.
Peter and the wolf head.
Peter and the wolf. Yes,
Peter
yes,
and the
yes.
wolf head.
And he starts reading this book. And the book is the story of a land named Fantasia or Fantastica, which, as I mentioned, is this Jungian theory that this is a place where all human fantasy lives together. South Park also did this in their Imagination Land.
Oh my God.
Series.
That's so true.
So true, right?
Imagination.
Spielberg and Lucas had their hands on this as well, because in the scene, the nothing, which is this threat, and in the book, the nothing is driven by something called manipulators, which basically like replace truths with lies, which is so relevant.
Yes. Oh my God.
So relevant. But, you know, in the movie, you see this whole council of imaginary creatures at this palace called the Ivory Tower. And the childlike empress, who is this goddess figure, who is the wisest in all of Fantasia, is dying. And the nothing is taking over. And once she dies, that's the end of Fantasia. And in the scene with the Ivory Tower, you can see Ewoks. You can see C-3PO. There are lots. So really, this is leaning into this whole theory that everything is here. I thought I saw those things when I was a kid, but I was like, impossible, because this is not a Steven Spielberg movie. Little did I know.
Which is also like how they have the E.T.'s relatives and the and the council and one of the Star Wars prequels.
E.T. is also at the council of the Ivory Tower.
What?
Yeah, okay. He is.
Yeah.
So they call
him. I like that the E.T.s just like stayed out of the Star Wars. Like, I guess they were conscientious objectors on that planet.
For sure. They're just they like about plants. Their plants. They're like, I'm going to bring, like, I don't want to deal with any of this. Like, you know, we're very
they, like,
neutral.
Bring you a flower after your dad cuts your hand off.
pretty much. So the childlike empress is dying, and Bastion becomes wrapped up in the story of Atreyu, who is this warrior who is coded Native American, I suppose the term would be. He is the part of the Plains people, and his people hunt the purple buffalo, and they give him something called the Orin, which every child in their wanted at that age.
It's very important for child fantasy stories to have accessories, I think.
It's beautiful. It's like the infinity symbol with snakes intertwined.
Gold and silver snakes. Yeah.
Steven Spielberg owns the original because he cut the film in order to make it accessible to American audiences. It's a very dark story. The three actors who were chosen to play, there is Barrett Oliver, who was Bastion. He was in a bunch of 80s sci-fi movies. Now he is unrecognizable, and he does this, he's this crazy, like, photo historian. He does something with the old way that photography used to be done. It's like Woodbury type.
Yeah.
Woodbury type.
He's unrecognizable.
Unrecognizable.
Yeah.
Noah Hathaway, who Sharon and I were discussing, Atreyu was very androgynous. He's in that point between boyhood and adulthood. But he's got long hair, and he's very emotional, which kind of ties back to the fact that, like, Bastion couldn't cry, but Atreyu mourns. And I love that. But Noah Hathaway, he was in Battlestar Galactica. He was in, I think, like, what was it, Leprechaun? He was in another horror movie, but he did not really do much acting after that. He became a tattoo artist, got tired of tattooing orins on people. I think he was, like, tasked with, like, 15 a week and was like,
oh, that's too many.
Too many. and then Tammy Stronach, this was her first acting job. She was the childlike empress.
And can I just say, this was her first acting job, and she really, I think, acted the heck out of that role. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, the two of the, you know, the boy actors were really good, but she, I don't know. I was really impressed to hear that, because she sells it.
And also, like, we know from The Phantom Menace that the childlike empress role is kind of hard to play, you know, in a way that isn't totally flat, basically. I think you're a childlike empress. What do you do with that? But yeah, when I was a kid and I saw this, I loved all of the characters and all of the leads. I had a big crush on Barrett Oliver. But also, like, I thought Tammy Stronach was, like, just incredible and unearthly. Like, I like the way that Brooke Shields was when she was young. Like, she also has that thing of, like, she's like 11, but she has sort of like the bearing and maturity, like the, at least the projected maturity of a grown ass lady. And you're like, how'd that happen?
Yeah. So the thing about Tammy Stronach is that her mother pulled her out of acting after this movie. Because
it was too much.
She thought it was too much to help her daughter navigate the turbulent waters of childhood stardom. And after The Neverending Story, she got unwanted attention from older men. They were telephone stalked. Adults proposed to her. She was 11. They mailed her engagement rings. And she got offers from Hollywood, obviously, to play roles featuring scenes with nudity. And they were like, absolutely not.
So because that was what we did in the 80s. He got a 12-year-old and he made her do weird sexual scenes, like nothing illegal, but definitely, you know, just like Brooke, again, Brooke Shields' whole career. I feel like I kind of foreshadowed that by mentioning Brooke Shields.
Yeah, I was thinking about that. I'm like, was that intentional? But so Tammy Stronach became a professional dancer, and she teaches dance, and I think she just entered the acting field again in her late 40s. So those were the main actors. So you have you have Wolfgang Petersen, you have these three actors, and then you have your non-human characters. So, and we're going to get to, we have to get to Artax. There's no way around it.
All right.
So Atreyu has his horse, Artax. Now, Noah Hathaway was injured several times on this set. There is a...
Where did they film this? Did they film this in Germany?
They filmed it in Germany. And Petersen is notable for having made his actors, or having had his actors, do their own stunts.
Noah if they're kids, who cares?
Yes. So I guess let's just get into Artax, because we're going there. In the book, Artax is a talking horse. In the movie, he is just your beautiful standard white horse that Atreyu rides, and they're best friends. And as soon as Atreyu leaves on this quest to figure out how he's going to save the childlike empress, he has to travel through something called the Swamps of Sadness. And if you let your depression and your despair overtake you, you sink into the Swamp of Sadness. And Atreyu, being an optimistic child and a warrior, is going, but he notices as he's traveling that Artax is not exactly making it.
And I think that in the book, the Orin protects him. Is that a plot point?
He offers it. Is that what
he offers it?
Research, yeah.
Okay.
He doesn't accept it, right?
The horse in the book tells him, go on, you don't have to see me die.
Oh, God.
Now, in the European cut, the German cut of the movie, there is, you hear the horse squealing.
Oh, God. Okay, this is funny. I noticed that they cut out of that scene fairly abruptly. And I was like, that's weird. I feel... I feel like there was something there, like it occurred to me, but I was like, well, I guess you just have to cut away abruptly because you can't show a horse's head get submerged because you can't harm horses to make your movie. But no, it was also that you know what? I appreciate being coddled as an American child. I didn't need to hear that.
It's very upsetting. In general, and I'm glad you mentioned the whole idea of harming horses to make a movie. I think it was it Milo and Otis where animals died? They did not do this. There were two horses that played Artax. They were treated better than Noah Hathaway.
I bet. Because I'm sure they had like someone monitoring. Well, I don't know, since it was Germany, they don't have, I don't know what protections they have, but I'm still concerned about our horse and child performers. I hope they have better laws now.
Oh, for sure. With Artax, the two Artaxes, because there's an urban legend that he actually did die in that scene.
Of course.
There was a 7-month training where they trained those horses as to, like, being comfortable being submerged.
That's awesome.
Yeah. It just blows my mind because it's the 80s and I really thought they were like, but really it was like, our child actors.
Well, something I wonder about is that like they Heaven's Gate, I forget when that came out, but it was like early 80s.
You're not talking about the cult. You're talking about
the movie. Yes. They're both disasters. Like never name anything Heaven's Gate, but you know, Heaven's Gate, the movie directed by Michael Cimino, who made The Deer Hunter at Lake, I feel like suffered from sort of the auteur movement where they were like, let's give him all the money he wants. I'm sure it'll work out in the end. It always does somehow. And it just went you know, incredibly over time, incredibly over budget. It was incredibly long. It was weirdly edited. It's got some amazing stuff, but like it was a tremendous flop. And the thing that makes it really unforgivable is like the horse deaths involved in making the film. And I feel as if like at this time in filmmaking, you could be like, okay, like kids, we can be a little casual with, but like, we're not going to fuck around with horses.
No, absolutely not. So this scene is like a rite of passage for children of a certain age, a certain era. I saw this movie, I think I mentioned this earlier, I was probably 6 or 7, and it broke me. But I always wanted to watch the movie, no matter what. Somebody put it on. It's like watching the Daleks from behind the couch. I would put my blanket over my head, and I would watch, and I would cry hysterically. My poor brother, who is 10 years younger than me, was given the same rite of passage, and he comes downstairs and he was crying, and I was like, oh, our text, like, because I was a horrible older sister, and he just burst out crying, and I'm like, you know, so
right there, that's like Gen X and like, you know, Gen Y right there, right? The difference between, well, deal with it, we dealt with it.
Yeah, totally. But after, you know, you see Atreyu, he's mourning. He mourns this death like Bastion was robbed of. He's being robbed of mourning his mother, and Bastion mourns with Atreyu. He's crying. You see him, and it is this is part of the whole thing. He's going on this journey with Atreyu, almost in like a Deus Ex Machina, which is not how it's done in the book. Situation in the movie, he's rescued because this is the point where you start seeing that he's being hunted by a wolf. He's rescued by Falcor, who is the luck dragon. Michael Enda hated the movie. This is notable.
If I were him, I'd hate it too.
He thought it was vile. He hated the fact that Falcor was supposed to look like a dragon. He was more of an Asian dragon. I thought he looked like a dog.
With a human nose.
With a human nose.
He called the movie a gigantic melodrama of kitsch, commerce, plush, and plastic.
But I loved it. I don't care. I loved it.
You know, well, it's not your book. And then you can write a book and they'll make a movie of it. And Michael Enda in the Heaven of German Writers will be like, I love that movie. And you'll be like, I hate it. And then you'll be even.
I mean, I don't want to rob him of that, because that's like me screaming about the Percy Jackson movie to everybody and their mother in 2010, where I'm like, what were they thinking? Do they even want to make money? This is a franchise and they blew it. But this movie, this book was so personal to him. It was so personal. And I don't want to rob that, because obviously I can't, but the movie being the first thing that I experienced was very personal in another way to me, because it did open up a lot of emotions. So Falcor the Luck Dragon has something in common with Gamork, who is this wolf that is hunting Atreyu.
Very funny name for a scary Gamork character.
Gamork. And the Rockbiter and the narrator. And this is that they are all voiced by Alan Oppenheimer, who millennials would know as Skeletor.
Oh, so he got around.
He got around. He is 90 years young and still voice acting. Fabulous.
Happy.
Yes, I thought you were going to tell me he died. I'm like, no! As of last night, he was alive!
That's my happy noise. I guess, like, I operate mostly in nonverbal noises, and they're hard to tell apart sometimes.
You scared me for a second.
I've been recently feeling, like, weirdly, and I have no right to have nostalgia about this, because, like, I don't work in these industries, but I've just been, like, annoyed lately at how Disney movies are now, like, really celebrity showcases. And it's like, you guys used to hire voice talent.
Yes.
And that was great.
Yes, that's true. And now they do. They, you know, like you would have even like the Disney princesses of the golden age were voice talent.
Paige O'Hara, who was Belle, and Jodie Benson, who was Ariel, were originally on the stage. And like they have that, you know, those yeah, like those yeah. voices, like Stradivarii or whatever.
So all of those three characters are voiced by Alan Oppenheimer. And that made me endlessly happy because I loved Skeletor as a kid. Loved Skeletor. So yay, Alan.
Can you talk briefly? Because like, I know of Skeletor. I know his work. I know he's opposed to He-Man. But like, and I guess I know that he's kind of a camp icon at this point.
He
I don't
is.
Know if you agree
yeah.
with that. Okay.
Yeah.
But like, tell me about your love of Skeletor.
I was a weird kid, Sarah. I was very, very strange. That is my love of Skeletor. I was like, yeah, I don't know, something about that purple undead guy who whines all the time. I yes. love him. I don't think I can really articulate why, but to me, like, He-Man was just boring. Mm-hmm. And Skeletor,
kind of redundant name.
He had a bone to pick with everybody. Talk about 80s masculinity, He-Man.
Could Skeletor have been on Could Skeletor have been on Hollywood Squares?
Yeah, I think so.
That would
be awesome.
wait, can I have to just, because you said Hollywood Squares, I have to interject that this really random piece of personal trivia. I was on Hollywood Squares.
What?
I don't even know if Jessica knows this crazy.
Is it scary to be up that high?
No, I wasn't in the squares. I was on.
Listen, they
came to New York. They filmed at Radio City Music Hall. And my dance school, my instructor used to be a Rockette, or she had some connection to Radio City Music Hall, Ella Marie. And they called us in a special meeting and they're like, guess what, guys? You're going to be on TV. And we were the Hollywood Squareettes. And I stood next to Kathy Lee and Frank Gifford. And she was very competitive with everyone else because we danced with them and she wanted to know the dance moves. And like, she grilled me. She's like, wait, what are the steps? And it was like Jim J. Bullock. It was the Fat Boys were on it. So sorry. Little
awesome. That's wonderful. This is the thing. It's like a lot of people have many, but like everybody has like some kind of hidden talent or like secret brush with celebrity, and like you might never know. It's amazing. I love that. I'm so happy you told that story.
I was not too far away from Alan Oppenheimer at a convention. Conventions happened, and usually the way that I meet people, the way that I networked back in the day, was I would awkwardly stumble onto somebody and then embarrass myself by talking to them. But I was not going to do that with Alan Oppenheimer. I was with my family and I'm really impressed that he's here and he looks amazing. Mm. And this is before I knew that he was Falcor, Gamork, and the Rockbiter. But I was like, no, I'm just really happy to be in his presence.
Yeah, I feel like it's like you could, you know, obviously people feel all kinds of different ways about it. And I think being an adult versus a child, like when you take one of these roles, is probably a big part of that too. But like, yeah, I read this interview with Mandy Patinkin recently where, you know, the interviewer, Rachel Syme, was like, how do you feel about like Inigo Montoya being the role that people really know you for? And people like, you know, just the phenomenon of that. He was like, oh, Rachel, it's amazing. It's incredible. Like to have people, you know, come up to you and tell you that like you were part of their childhoods basically in that way. And if he had been someone else who played that role, he could just as easily be like, I hate it. I don't know why people don't ask me about Sondheim, but like,
totally.
You know, it's like, you just, yeah, at a certain, if you're able to embrace it, that seems really great.
Kind of like when I awkwardly stumbled into John Leguizamo at a convention, and like the only thing I could think of was, "You're my favorite Tybalt."
That's really great. That's a great sentence to hear.
And then I just kind of was like, "I was all right." And then I just like ran away. I'm like,
the deep field, the Tybalts, you know. Everybody's Tybalted.
Oh, he was the best. He was so good. Gamork. I'm glad you mentioned Mandy Patinkin because he, Rufio from Hook, and a certain scene with Gamork have something in common that traumatized me as a kid. Now, going back to how Noah Hathaway was almost killed in this movie several times, Gamork At one point, he separated from Falcor, and he is confronted with this wolf, which is hunting him, and they end up in a rough and tumble. It looks like Noah Hathaway is having trouble getting the corpse of Gamork off his body, and that is not untrue. That was one take, and he almost lost his eye because they lost control of the puppet.
Oh my god.
Ooh. Yeah.
They just did not care about these child actors.
Jesus. Oh my god. I feel like being a child actor in the 80s was like working in a coal mine.
Oh, totally. It was a sweatshop. Going back to Bible, it's a sweatshop. Yeah. We'll find another Noah Hathaway. Who needs him? But the three things was stabbing. I was terrified I was going to be stabbed as a child. So Rufio was the only bloodless stabbing, but that was the last of the three. I saw both Princess Bride and Hook in the same movie theater, beautiful movie theater that does not exist anymore in Syosset, old-fashioned movie theater with like a mezzanine. Never-ending story. I was too young to see in the theater. But both the stabbing of Gamork and the stabbing of Inigo Montoya were so bloody. Mm-hmm. And then when, spoiler alert, Rufio is stabbed, that was it. I was like, I am going to get stabbed. This is terrifying.
I mean, honestly, of all the fears you could come away from fantasy movies with, that's like probably the most practical.
It's realistic. Like, it's a thing that happens. Yeah. Right? You know, yeah. I mean, it's more realistic than almost getting crushed by a wolf puppet that takes your eye out.
Or getting sneezed really on is. By a giant turtle.
Although if you're working with an artistic German director, I feel like either could happen to you.
True.
Not Wolfgang Petersen, but, you know, an auteur of some kind. They stab people. I think Dennis Hopper, like, this wasn't a stabbing, but he was like, apparently I love movies that everyone hated and that were nightmares to make because I know all these stories about them. But when Dennis Hopper was in Human Highway, the weird Neil Young movie, he like was playing with knives. He was like throwing knives around or something. And he like seriously injured one of the other actors. And it's like, yeah, just don't work with Dennis Hopper.
Don't work with Wolfgang Petersen, especially if you're a kid.
Yeah. Because don't work with men.
Yeah.
Take away their sharp things. And yeah.
Soft puppets.
Soft puppets.
So leading up to that scene where, you know, he almost lost an eye, there's this whole, you know, he's hiding from the nothing and he stumbles upon this sort of cave, right? And you're in like the fresco room. And then, you know, Atreyu, I'm talking about, he's sort of seeing on the wall these depictions of what has happened on his quest. So, you know, he's looking at, you know, his meeting, he's writing Artax, he's, you know, all these different things that have happened.
Artax dying.
So
right, there was a fresco of Artax dying again. So if you were not over that, by the way, here is an artistic rendition of that
like
happening.
In case you forgot.
Right. So then he's getting like increasingly freaked out, and that kind of leads into Gamork and that whole battle and whatever. But like, that scene kind of messed me up because I was like, how is that happening? He's looking at these are old paintings. Who painted this? Like, how did they know? You know, it was like this sort of interesting little scene that I always thought about. So it just leads back to the whole thing of this being like, it being cyclical about there being like, he's not the first guy to attempt this. And the childlike empress, she needs a new name every so often. And, you know, this is not the first time, you know, we've been to this movie before, you know, this has happened, whatever. But like, that could be part of that fresco. It could be part of like when Atreyu is watching another warrior attempt to go through. And we didn't talk about the Oracle.
We'll get there. But, so Bastion's, it's like, it's so meta. It's a story within a story. And we do flashback to Bastion a few times, but Atreyu is going on the hero's quest, but it's like the most depressing hero's quest ever.
Yes. Oh my God. Finding and losing dads.
He's told to visit Morla the Ancient One, which is kind of like throwing into the book. First of all, Morla to me looks like E.T. But she's a giant turtle who lives in the swamp. And he actually, I believe, like, does he meet Morla before he meets Falcor?
I think so. Yeah, yeah, because yeah. He's like, cause she's like, you have to travel 10,000 miles. And I was like, why are they saying miles and not kilometers? And I was completely lost. But anyway, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah. Totally took me out of it.
Oh, no. And so Morla is supposed to be wise. And in the book, it's kind of implied that this is not the first time the childlike empress has died. Sharon and I read a really interesting article by somebody, Cinema of her
52.
Yeah, I don't know. Cinema 52. Just about Morla. Morla is like suffering from like, what is it, nihilism? Like, I did not get this as a child.
He says we do not even care whether we care or not.
She's just, yeah, she's supposed to give him like, you know, like the also, charge.
Very forward thinking with the pronoun usage. Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's true. That's true. Well, she Morla calls Morla's self we because mm-hmm. Morla has been on their own for so long. I'm going to go with that. I'm going to lean into mm-hmm. that, Sharon. Sure. That Morla speaks to ourselves. So whether it's the royal we or a pronoun we, mm-hmm. You know,
Morla has transcended, but
Morla does not care. Is very apathetic to the fact, yeah, I know that, you know, we have not seen the Orin in a long time, implying that other heroes of Fantasia have come and said, Morla, what can I do? But at this point, Morla just doesn't care. Morla's waiting for the nothing.
Yeah.
To just come.
I'm really struck by just how, like, it never occurred to me to see this as a parallel between World War II and the story at all. Like when I read this book, I must have been 11 or 12 and I just took it all completely literally. And it just feels like it's entirely in front of my face. And I feel like even this is like, you're like, the Nazis are coming. What are we going to do? And, or we are the Nazis. What are we going to do about that? And
are we the baddies?
Yeah. Yeah. And how, like, when, you know, in real life, like there's always a contingent of Morlas who's like, well, whatever, I'm withdrawing from the situation because I feel disempowered to do anything about it. Or maybe I feel like this has played out a million times already and I'm too tired. And yeah, I don't know. It just, I knew as a kid that there was a ton going on in this book, but I think I just couldn't really see a lot of it at the time.
I think for me, because I was a child, I was, when the movie came out, was I five? But you know, I had relatives who had escaped the Nazis and I knew that this was a German movie. By the way, it was dubbed into English and filmed in German, which is
great because I did not pick up on that. And like, it looks pretty good.
So, like the side characters.
Yes.
Oh, the side. Yeah. Oh, yeah. So I guess if you're a puppet, it's a lot easier.
Yeah. Well, also Deep Roy, who played, I think his name was like Teeny Weeny. He was the on the racing snail. His voice was dubbed twice, which makes no sense. But they just didn't like Deep Roy's voice for that role. I don't know why.
But Schwarzenegger.
Night Hob. You could notice
the
it.
Night Hob. That
right.
The German dubbing. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, I was very aware, you know, because the relatives on my father's side were very wary of anything German. Mm-hmm. So I almost, like, it was almost dangerous for me to watch this movie. And I didn't understand that the author, just everything involving it was so anti-fascism. But as a kid, you sort of absorb the fears of your elders. So it was almost dangerous. And I love it. I love everything about the book and the movie more knowing what I know about it now.
Mm-hmm. I think probably in America today, like I would hope that a lot of people are feeling more empathetic with what it was to be sort of a German civilian time. Cause you're like, as a kid, as a student in high school, et cetera, like, for whatever reason, and maybe we teach history in a way that encourages this, like I just kind of thought countries were like these organisms that all kind of got the same idea. Like nobody told me that. That's just the kind of oversimplification that your brain makes to, you know, not freak you out too much. And now I'm like, okay, how many people were just kicking and screaming the whole time and it didn't matter? Like, it's just, that's not, I don't know. It's like, it's pretty distressing to realize that that can be an entire contingent of a nation when you're a kid, I think.
It's the concept of the resistance that I think didn't exist as a child in the same way when they would depict, you know, the Soviet Union with all these stereotypes, like in Rocky and whatever.
Yes.
You know, you just think like, well, that's how they are. And that's just the whole country. And the idea of the resistance.
Everyone in Russia is gigantic and wants to punch your whole head off.
Totally. The other creatures that he meets, there's the rock biter who, going again back to this whole like mirror of masculinity, you have Gerald McRaney telling Bastion to get over it, and then you have the rock biter who's this big strong guy. And the audience meets the rock biter early on in the story when he's with two other characters, the Deep Roy character that we mentioned before, and also the man with the bat glider. And they're all discussing the nothing and how it's affecting their land. Now, Atreyu meets him again towards the end after the nothing literally had ripped the other characters from his hands before we see him in this scene. And it's the scene where he's saying, these big strong hands, and I couldn't even do anything to save my friends.
That scene really broke my heart this time, and I didn't remember it being especially heartrending when I was younger, and like maybe that's a more adult pain, because it's not about losing kind of, I know that it's weird for me to call Atreyu's horse his parent figure, but like
he was
horses are bigger than you. That's one of the main things about them. And like, yeah. And I feel like this is a more adult trauma of, you know, just like you thought you were strong. You thought you knew what you were capable of doing in the world. And it turns out that you're not at all.
Or you're a parent and you want to protect your children, or you want to protect your family. I mean, I know, you know, when it was just me and my husband, there was like this feeling of like, okay, well, you know, we'll figure this out. But like when you have other beings that rely on you, you're like the rock biter. You have to figure out when you're going to let them go. And it is almost like, I guess it is, you can consider it like a father grieving for his children.
Yeah. And especially like, again, like not to zoom out too much, but like the whole concept of war and how like we have to teach people like now, like murder is terrible. It's the worst thing you can do. You're not human if you commit a murder, like we just throw you away. Actually, in Germany, they have a much better prison system now. But anyway, but then like war is this completely different situation. And if the government tells you to go and kill or be killed, then like you are going to do it. I mean, seeing him as a parent like really doubles that impact for me, because it makes sense. And just like, you know, yeah, we did a Why Are Dads episode recently where we talked about the Rankin Bass Hobbit, which I also love very much. And I was talking about how like weirdly that was kind of a safe movie for me when I was a kid, because it was very scary, but it wasn't sad. Or it is sad at the end, actually, when Thorin dies and everything, but it's mostly, it's scary, and it's about adult characters dealing with scary stuff, and I really loved it. And how just like the ones with childlike characters, people losing parents, people just being in hopeless situations are like too much, and I just cry the whole time. And like maybe I'll cry less if I like have kids and they want to watch them over and over, who knows. And then someone on Twitter was like, well, you know, not to speak to your experience, but like I cry more now that I'm a parent, because now I'm thinking about my kids that I personally have to keep safe. And I was like, oh, fuck. I'm never going to be able to watch Disney movies without, you know, worrying about my electrolytes. So, all right.
It's a thing. It's a thing. I mean, there's just a lot. And if you want to keep going with the theme about parents, so the Southern Oracle, ultimately, Morla is just kind of like, I really just don't care, but I guess you can ask the Southern Oracle how to, you know, figure this out. First of all, Atreyu is super brave against Gamork. He's just like, Gamork's like, I'm searching for Atreyu, recounts all the horrible things that happened to Atreyu. I lost him here. And Atreyu's like, come for me. I am Atreyu. And then the stabbing that haunted Jessica for the rest of her life happens. and the eye thing that haunted Noah Hathaway happened. Falcor rescues him and brings him to this old couple. And the woman, Patricia Hayes, who's the old woman, is in Willow and in a bunch of other movies. She and her husband, is it Fizzywig, I think?
Engiwook.
I'm thinking Fizzgig. I'm like, no,
that's,
it's not
Harry
Fizzgig.
Potter candy, isn't it? Anyway,
it sounds like it. I mean, you know, like, not like J.K. Rowling has ever, you know, like, taken anything from anything.
And then
else,
there's,
so, yeah,
you know, there's Fozzywig's Rubber Chicken Factory and the Muppet Christmas Carol, of course.
It
yeah.
Could be, yes, that is where I'm at. There's this quarrelsome couple, and like, I always associated them with Miracle Max. Valerie from The Princess Bride. Because
Me
you've
too.
Got this quarrelsome couple who, like, they clearly love each other, but they also hate each other.
Yeah. Because, you know, they're very couples. Old and they're magic and they've just been like, yeah, these are clearly people who really want company. So that works out well.
And they don't have children, as far as we can tell. They have this little boy that they can nurse back to health. And on one hand, Urgel, like, you know, she's being motherly and she's giving him soup, or, you know, I guess gender role motherly. And Angiwook just wants to talk to him about, like, his scientific studies. And
He's going to write a book, or he did write a book. He's studying the Southern Oracle. Yeah,
he's all of us. He'll forever be writing that book. Mm-hmm. But the Southern Oracle are these two sphinxes that are staring at one another. Enda hated them. He thought because they were busty that they were, I think he likened them to strippers.
Do sphinxes, are they typically busty?
I don't know. I don't think so, but maybe I'm wrong. I'm trying
to
remember.
Hollywood.
The sphinxes moved to Hollywood and they went to see a plastic surgeon in Bel Air.
Definitely.
At least they didn't ask Tammy Stronach to show anything in this movie, but the sphinxes, who were inanimate objects.
Well, that's a good way to take heat off your human performers. It's totally funny because, like, I'm sure that that we know this, or at least there are a lot of compelling theories about it, but looking at the Sphinx in Egypt, I'm like, well, she could have had boobs at one time, not anymore.
I mean, I think, like, in a lot of mythology, sphinxes are female.
But also, like, this is probably too much in the weeds, but, like, I do feel like I get what he's saying, because they, like, if you were to do, like, an ancient Egyptian sphinx with breasts, you would give it, like, ancient breasts. And if you were to do 80s, a Hollywood, like, they look like they were in a ZZ Top video, those sphinxes.
That's true.
Had some work. Well, you know, this is sort of the part, right, where they're watching from Ingiwood. He has this crazy kind of telescope thing that he has, like, brewing potions and crystals. And it's a very cool prop that they have. And they're watching this other warrior go through, and he's kind of like coaching Atreyu and sort of like explaining, you know, these different, the gates and the tests that they have to pass. And basically he's admitting he's never done it. Like, that he's writing
a researcher.
He's a researcher, but he's like, I've never done it myself, but I've watched a lot of people try. And then you actually see, like, you know, this warrior with, like, all this, you know, armor go through and get, you know, blitzed or whatever. And
with the Sphinx's eyes open.
Yeah. And the laser eyes come out and whatever. So no, my thought was like, oh, okay. Are we watching, like, other people who've come before to try to save Fantasia? Or is this just some, like, there's like a call has been put out to all of the Fantasians that, you know, that they need to save to fight against the nothing. And every warrior is now called to arms and they're all trying this. And that's why he's been watching them. Like, it's just, that always interests me. It's like, how many people besides Atreyu are trying to save the princess right now, you know? And that sort of thought was always kind of like, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Like, how many people in the story, like, can understand the story that they're inside of?
You know, how many have tried and failed to make
it
to this
But Atreyu is the only one with the Orin. He is the one who has been sent specifically to do this task. You know, in order to pass the first test, which the gate, he has to be confident. And if the Sphinxes see that you are not confident, their eyes will open and they will shoot lasers simultaneously at you, which will vaporize you, because Atreyu goes near them and he sees the skeleton. So Sharon, you had a really interesting point about whether or not he failed that test.
Well, yeah, because so you're led to believe that if he has the confidence to go past, that their eyes won't open and he'll be allowed to go through, right?
Which is affecting Bastion, because Bastion is yelling, and we've already seen Bastion, by the way, interact with Atreyu, because with Morla, he screams and Atreyu hears him.
So you know that there's that connection. There's a whole thing about duality that actually comes up in the next test with the mirror. However, the whole point of the Southern Oracle to me was, did he pass the test? Was he confident and make it through? And did he really, you know, believe who he was or whatever? Or did he fail and just make it anyway and just like run through the test? Because that's what it looked like. I was like,
that's what I thought. Yeah.
You know,
and then it's like it's and they're like, well, it's actually a trick and you don't have to be confident, you just have to be a very fast child.
Yeah, or because he was shorter, because he was a child, like I don't know.
80s video games taught you everything about timing,
right.
if you dodge that Goomba while you jump, you will get to the next board in Mario. So
it is a muddled scene. Like, we're not really sure. Like, you know, did he pass? Mm-hmm. Did he fail?
I didn't think he did, because ultimately, by the time he gets back to the Ivory Tower, there's like he kind of didn't 100% make it back in the way that he was supposed to. And then you have the second gate confused me, because basically he just looks into a mirror and sees Bastion reading a book and they look at each other. As a kid, I was like, Angiwolf is like, oh, it's even worse than the first. I was like, there's no skeletons in that second gate. How is that worse? Right. It's weird, but...
Because Angiwook is projecting, because he isn't at peace with the fact that he's a nerd and doesn't like nerds.
Yeah.
But so the question, you know, is, as a child, your true self is not the same concept as an adult, who, as we know, you know, you have your what you're projecting to the world, who you think you are, and then to have like a mirror held up to you and it's not what you know, like they're showing your true self. And I think it just reads differently as, like you were saying, like as an adult, kind of like this concept. When you're a child, you don't really get that. You're just kind of still innocent, whatever. And you're just like, oh, you know, I don't do my homework sometimes. It's kind of like when they make children confess, and they're like, you know, the Catholic Church, which I have some background with, where you go and you confess and you're like, well, I didn't eat my vegetables and I yelled at my brother. And it's like, well, who are you to make a child confess when they're still innocent? That's a whole other story. But it's that whole concept of like your true self as a child. It's like, what have you really done? Like, how bad can you be as opposed to an adult? I think that's why that scene does resonate differently for an adult.
I think also it's part of adulthood is sort of constructing personas consciously or unconsciously and sort of finding the ways that you feel comfortable in a social crowd or a profession or whatever. And then like, I do feel like the work of adulthood partly is maintaining an understanding of who you are, despite the fact that you will find yourself to be different people in the same day. And some of them will not feel great after a while.
Like Bilbo Baggins, like you will not be the same when you return from this journey. So it works for me on two layers now, especially rewatching it. So on two layers, you have maybe it's Atreyu realizing he only exists because Bastion is reading about him. But another thought is going back to the fact that you have these 12-year-old characters that were in the book, you know, written, the source material deals with someone whose childhood ended at 12. They're both on the precipice of adulthood and they're connected because they're connected through trauma in a way. Bastion has his own trauma, and he's now appropriating Atreyu's while he's reading the story. But Atreyu is being sent to essentially bring Bastion, make Bastion so upset that he is not going to keep his feet on the ground like Gerald McRaney told him to, and he's going to allow fantasy into his life and become the savior of Fantasia, which is where everything was going. He is the one to give the Empress a new name.
Speaking
of semiotics and sort of this being, you know, about the powers of language in a way a child can understand. Like, as a kid, I loved that resolution so much because it was like, I don't know, like this is a book for readers, like, right? Like there are books that are like, that are great and that anyone can enjoy, and anyone can enjoy this book probably. But also it, like it really, I remember it feeling so much like it was about the world that you live in when what you experience when you read is as, or perhaps much more important to you than what happens in your day-to-day life. And as that kind of kid, like that was just like the fact that it's there at the level of plot, just, I just love that so much.
Me too. Do you think, okay, so the confidant of the childlike empress, his name is, I believe he's a centaur in the book, and his name is Chiron, in case nobody knew that. Is he a father figure to the childlike empress? She's supposed to be the wisest being.
Yeah.
But he is, like, he always read as fatherly to me.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's funny because in the book, I remember that she had white hair. And she was, well, yeah.
Atreyu had green skin,
right?
Too.
So, in some ways, this might have worked better as a cartoon, but all, you know, whatever, or could work still.
They tried that; it wasn't very good.
Yeah,
they did. It was not great. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
recently or like
a long time ago. Maybe better now, but
yeah. It's a thought.
Right.
Talk to the end of people, but but yeah, I feel as if like in. I mean, another thing about fantasy that I think is really like maybe less obvious now that you can really render practically anything using special effects or CGI or whatever. Like, I love how in this movie, like, it's very obvious that we are limited by basically the limitations of what can physically be built in some way. And they're able to use green screens and, and probably like matte paintings and stuff like that. But it's like, everything is like physically there in space, as far as I can tell. And just the fact that when you're reading fantasy as a kid, and maybe your imagination is like even better when you're younger, you can imagine anything. Like you can't imagine a childlike empress who is ancient and eternal and yet also childlike and unaging. And then you see a kid playing that role. And even if she's really great, you're like, that's a kid. With a dad type guy.
Just like I saw the people behind the costumes back in Disney. It's much better now, but there was when I was a kid and I went to Disney World, I could always see them behind the eyes.
Yeah.
I was like, that's not Goofy. First of all, Goofy's smooth looking.
Yeah, he's not
and
plush.
I see a person who's behind there. So, yeah. Yeah, it's really just very effective. And I love it. I love the book. I love the movie. I love everything about it. The more that I know where, like, that it came about, trauma. And I love the score. And there's two different scores. There's the score.
Really?
Yes. So the aside, Sharon and I, back when we did SciCon 2019, which is the library's Comic-Con, it was an 80s theme. And we sang the theme. Together. Mm. This is in the wake of Stranger Things. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like they did a duet in Stranger Things of the Neverending Stories theme song. So
and
Sharon
loved it, by the way. They were dancing in the aisles. We were like in the theater singing karaoke. And
somebody has that odd video somewhere. That song, I did not realize it existed outside of the movie until I heard it on somebody's playlist. And then I'm like, well, I need to download it. But the scoring in the movie, Spielberg was very instrumental in changing the scoring. He cut a lot of things for pace. He cut a scene out that was not important, where Bastion was almost discovered by a caretaker in the attic. He really was like, okay, for American audiences, this needs to move a little bit faster. So the music is a little bit different. There's more synth in one than the other. The Ivory Tower theme, which I think is beautiful in the cut that we know, is actually a slowed down version of like the flying theme. And then the Swamp of Sadness song is the Swamp of Sadness song. And it is like, it's a little bit different. Like I said, there's a little synth in one than the other, but all I have to do is listen to that music and I start to cry.
And there's, I had no idea Spielberg was involved, and
of course Spielberg was involved.
Of course Spielberg was involved. And also, and like, I mean, it's fun. Like, I'm extremely curious about what it would be like to watch the German cut of it. I'm sure it's very similar, because like these, you know, like, yeah, just thinking about like who was in making those decisions at the time and saying like, this music will play better to American kids, and this is what, like, we need like more uplift or something. Like, it needs to be, was it like to just make it feel kind of less sad?
Well, yeah, because the decision to take Artex's squealing out of that scene, you know, in the book, Artex,
a good call.
I'm really glad Artex did not speak in the movie, because I don't think, I think it would have been hokey. And it's very difficult, especially in this time period with special effects, to make a movie with talking animals that's not hokey.
I mean, look at Mr. Ed.
I was just going to say, Mr. Ed and the cat. And,
it doesn't really put you in, like, a sad place to watch that the horse moving his big mouth around for whatever reason.
I do wonder, as a parent myself, when I will be showing this to my kids. Because I can't I can't not do it. I don't know whether everything will look cheesy to them, but I would hope that the emotional impact of both the book and the movie remain, because I think they're both very important.
I think puppets are kind of timeless. You know, I'm sure there's aspects of this that would look kind of silly, but I think that a late 90s movie where we just had that early CGI where everything looked really smooth, like, I think that has aged much worse.
Puppets are kind of timeless.
It's funny to me too, like, you know, I know that there's like a whole universe of like thoughts about timing and when do we do this and how do I introduce this concept, but I feel like parents in the 80s were like, it's 11 o'clock, do you know where your children are? Are your kids doing crack? And the children who were worried about by those parents are like, when are we going to introduce our kids to the TV that our parents just, you know, let us access in kind of a smorgasbord? And like, when will my child be ready for this sadness versus like, how do I stop my child from becoming a drug dealer? I don't know.
Or just like a person who doesn't have empathy. Like, to me, that's why these stories are really important, because you're seeing little boys cry in the 80s when little boys were absolutely not supposed to cry. Absolutely not. And you're experiencing grief on a pretty high level. And just the idea of like, you don't, nihilism, you don't, I don't care. Like, you know, like, go one way or the other, it doesn't matter. I'm just going to sit here and eventually die. I think it's still really important. And maybe I'm on a high horse, not Artex here. But I think that's why so many of us who grew up with this love it so much, in spite of the fact that it's like a collective trauma.
I think people feel that way about The Last Unicorn too.
Oh, totally.
And like, that was an interesting one for me to watch, because I had never seen it before we watched it to talk about it on the show. And so since I wasn't, and so the whole time I was just like, how would I have felt about all this as a little kid? I know I would have loved it. It's just the kind, like, I was the kind of kid who wanted diaries with ribbons in them. So that's like the exact demographic for that movie, I think.
Yeah.
And just, yeah, but I feel as if that movie is doing the same thing that this one is, and mm-hmm. certainly that this book is doing even more for a kid audience, which is to be like, here's a story with a lot of themes in it. And like, we're going to explain some stuff, but like, certainly not all of it. And also just that, you know, like, I really, I don't mean for my role here to be like anti-Disney, but you know, they can take the heat. They're very powerful. I feel like, you know, the moral of a lot of Disney movies is like, believe in yourself. And it's like, okay, but like, should everyone believe in themselves? Should Jared Kushner believe in himself quite so much? Like, why is Simba qualified to be in charge? Should he believe in himself? These are all valid questions.
You're not pro-Scar. You're just saying, like, why, why is Simba in charge? Simba has been away for a while.
Why do we have a two-lion system in the Pride Lands, really? Right.
And there, there should be a system of government, of voting, as to who becomes...
Yes, or something. Or just, like, are these herbivores here of their own volition?
Are they afraid that they're going to be part of the circle of life?
I don't really think that you can have voluntary parliamentary government when everyone's showing up to welcome the birth of the new Lion King. You know, it's just a weird, it's
like,
weird.
And people first.
Right. It's like, is that, it's a buffet. Yeah. And I mean, people have talked about how the remake, it's like so much weirder in that. Cause if they're not these animated stylized animals, you're like, oh, this has some implications. And yeah, I just, I feel like Disney, there's so many things they're good at. They are good at compressing a story into like a very specific and clear message with maybe some less thought out themes. And sometimes you need that. And sometimes you need something that is like weird and clearly for kids and adults at the same time, and that has all kinds of little stories running in and out of it, and all kinds of little ideas that it seems like some of them the writer has thought out what they mean and what a child will take from them, and some they're just like, I don't know, it was interesting to me, maybe you'll like it.
Well, Henson, Lucas, and Spielberg did all of that. I think Henson for sure.
Yeah.
You know, I think like Spielberg and Lucas eventually became much more commercial than Henson could have been when he was alive. But I know that
Jim Henson's big thing was like everyone was, or, you know, at the beginning, people didn't think of them as being for children. And I guess that happened over time. But yeah, that like the Muppets are, that they like are entertainers generally who happen to find a lot of success with children. I will say as a final thing, I think the single moment that I most appreciated when I was watching this was that, because I think the only time I watched this movie, I was a middle schooler. I wasn't a big crier at the time. I was taking a break from being a big crier and was very focused on how, you know, the movie is different from the book and I don't like it. And so it just like, it definitely touched me, but like not nearly as deeply as this time. So I did a lot more crying this time is what I'm trying to say. And what I like loved the moment that happened where basically, you know, I mean, it's, as we've been saying this whole time, it's so painful, but like the moment where Atreyu has tried and failed to save Artax, or he is trying and failing, like we're in the thick of that moment. And Atreyu is crying and Bastion is reading about it and he's crying and I'm watching it and I'm crying and we're all crying like the same amount, the same way. And we're all crying together. And I just love that. Like, I love, you know, we're going to find out as the movie progresses that the layers of story are a little bit more complicated, but at the time it's like, you're watching a boy experiencing a child's pain inside of a story and like accessing that inside of himself and crying. And then like you or I, as I'm consuming the story, I'm doing the exact same thing that Bastion is doing. And it's just like this Russian nesting doll. It's beautiful. I just thought that was like, that moment belongs in a museum.
It is in the Museum of Our Mind. I've heard samples of the music come up in some of my children's cartoons because they always want to somehow, you know, appeal to adults. Like, adults don't watch cartoons. I do. I want to watch these shows with my kids. I want something we can watch together. But I had heard some sampling of the background music or the theme music in a few of my kids' cartoons. And then it's like, Mommy, why are you crying? This is funny. No, it's not. I mean, not the Swamp of Sands theme.
How human memory works. And
Yeah. Once again, thank you for doing this. This was amazing, reliving this trauma. Please come back and do it again. We'll pick another traumatic movie.
There's so many.
So many. This was Jessica with Syosset Public Library. My librarian co-host was...
Hi, Sharon. And
our fabulous guest host was...
Sarah Marshall.
And we are closing this chapter of Turn the Page.
It's time to close this chapter of Turn the Page. Join us for the next episode.